Sons and Lovers by D.H. Lawrence. When the coal and iron fields of Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire were discovered, the firm of Carston, Waite and Company was one of the first to appear on the scene. Amid tremendous excitement, Lord Palmerston formally opened the company's first mine at Spinney Park, on the edge of the Sherwood Forest. Carston, Waite and Company found they had struck on a good thing, so down the valleys of the Brooks from Selby and Nuttall, new mines were sunk, until soon there were six pits working. From Nuttall, high up on the sandstone among the woods, the railway ran down to Spinney Park, then on to Minton, a large mine among cornfields. From Minton across the farmlands of the valleyside to Bunker's Hill, branching off there and running north to Beggarlees and Selby. Six mines, like black studs on the countryside, linked by a loop of fine chain, the railway. To accommodate the regiments of miners, Carston, Waite and Company built the squares, great quadrangles of dwellings on the hillside of Bestwood, and then, in the Brook Valley, they erected the bottoms. The bottoms consisted of six blocks of miners' dwellings, two rows of three, like the dots on a blank six domino, and 12 houses in a block. This double row of dwellings sat at the foot of the rather sharp slope from Bestwood, and looked out, from the attic windows at least, on the slow climb of the valley towards Selby. Gertrude Morell was not anxious to move into the bottoms, which was already 12 years old and on the downward path when she descended to it from Bestwood. But it was the best she could do. She came down in the July, and in the September expected her third baby. She was 31 years old and had been married 8 years. Gertrude Morell came of a good old burgher family. Her grandfather had gone bankrupt in the lace market at a time when so many lace manufacturers were ruined in Nottingham. Her father, George Coppard, was an engineer, a large, handsome, haughty man, proud of his fair skin and blue eyes, but more proud still of his integrity. Gertrude resembled her mother in her small build, but her temper, proud and unyielding, she had from the Coppards. When she was 23 years old, she met, at a Christmas party, a young man from the Erewash Valley. Morell was then 27 years old. He was well set up, erect, and very smart. He had wavy black hair, ruddy cheeks, and a red, moist mouth, which was noticeable because he laughed so often and heartily. He had that rare thing, a rich, ringing laugh. Gertrude Coppard had watched him, fascinated. He was so full of colour and animation, he was so ready and pleasant with everybody. She herself was the opposite. She had a curious, receptive mind which found much pleasure and amusement in listening to other folk. She loved ideas and was considered very intellectual. What she liked most of all was an argument on religion or philosophy or politics with some educated man. Walter Morell seemed melted away before her. She was to the miner that thing of mystery and fascination, a lady. Gertrude Coppard watched him as he danced, a certain subtle exultation like glamour in his movement. She thought him rather wonderful, never having met anyone like him. She was rather contemptuous of dancing. She had not the slightest inclination towards that accomplishment. She was a Puritan, like her father. Therefore, the dusky, golden softness of this man's sensuous flame of life that flowed off his flesh like the flame from a candle seemed to her something miraculous. He came and bowed above her. A warmth radiated through her as if she had drunk wine. "Now, do come and have this one with me," he said caressively. "It's easy, you know. I'm pining to see you dance." She smiled, and her smile was very beautiful. It moved the man so that he forgot everything. "No, I won't dance," she said softly. Not knowing what he was doing, he often did the right thing by instinct. He sat beside her, inclining reverentially.
"But you mustn't miss your dance," she reproved.
"Nay, I don't want to dance that. It's not one as I care about."
"Yet you invited me to it."
He laughed very heartily at this. "I never thought of that. That not long in taking a curl out of me." It was her turn to laugh quickly.
"You don't look as if you'd come much uncurled," she said.
"I'm like a pig's tail. I curl because I can't help it," he laughed.
"Are you a miner?" she said.
"Yes. I went down when I was 10.
She looked at him in wondering dismay. 10? Wasn't it very hard?
"You soon get used to it. You live like the mice, and you pop out at night to see what's going on."
She looked at him, startled. This was a new tract of life suddenly opened before her. She realized the life of the miners, hundreds of them toiling below the earth and coming up at evening. He seemed to her noble. He risked his life daily and with gaiety. The next Christmas, they were married, and for 3 months she was perfectly happy. They lived, so she thought, in his own house. It was small but convenient enough and quite nicely furnished, with solid, worthy stuff that suited her honest soul. Sometimes, when she herself wearied of love talk, she tried to open her heart seriously to him. She saw him listen deferentially, but without understanding. This killed her efforts at a finer intimacy, and she had flashes of fear. Sometimes he was restless of an evening. It was not enough for him just to be near her, she realized. But in the 4th month, when she was brushing his Sunday coat, she felt papers in the breast pocket, and, seized with a sudden curiosity, took them out to read. They were the bills of the household furniture, still unpaid. "Look here," she said that night, after he was washed and had his dinner. "I found these in the pocket of your Sunday coat. Haven't you settled the bills yet?"
"No, I haven't had a chance."
"But you told me all was paid. I'd better go into Nottingham on Saturday and settle them. I don't like sitting on another man's chairs and eating from an unpaid table. I can have your bank book, can't I?"
"Thou can I it, for what good it'll be to thee."
He had told her he had a good bit of money left over. She realized it was no use asking questions. She sat rigid with bitterness and indignation. The next day she went down to see his mother. "Didn't you buy the furniture for Walter?" she asked.
"Yes, I did," the elder woman retorted.
"And how much did he give you to pay for it?"
£80, if you're so keen on knowing."
£80? But there are £42 still owing."
"I can't help that."
"But where's it all gone?"
"You'll find all the papers, I think, if you look, beside £10 as he owes me, and £6 as the wedding cost down here."
£6? Echoed Gertrude Morell.
It seemed to her monstrous that, after her own father had paid so heavily for her wedding, £6 more should have been squandered in eating and drinking at Walter's parents' house.
"And how much has he sunk in his houses?" she asked.
"His houses? Which houses?"
Gertrude went white to the lips. He had told her the house he lived in and the next one was his own. "I thought the house we live in," she began.
"They're my houses, those two," said the mother-in-law. "And not clear either. It's as much as I can do to keep the mortgage interest paid."
"Then we ought to be paying you rent."
"Walter is paying me rent. 6 and 6 a week."
It was more than the house was worth. Although she said nothing to her husband about it, her manner changed towards him. Something in her proud, honourable soul had crystallized out hard as rock. Gertrude Morell was very ill when her 3rd child was born. Morell was good to her, as good as gold. But she felt very lonely, miles away from her own people. She felt lonely with him now, and his presence only made it more intense. The boy was small and frail at first, but he came on quickly. He was a beautiful child, with dark gold ringlets and dark blue eyes. His mother loved him passionately. He came just when her own bitterness of disillusion was hardest to bear. when her faith in life was shaken and her soul felt dreary and lonely. She made much of the child, and the father was jealous. At last, Mrs. Morell despised her husband. She turned to the child. She turned from the father. He had begun to neglect her. The novelty of his own home was gone. He had no grit, she said bitterly to herself. What he felt just at the minute, that was all to him. There began a battle between the husband and wife. She fought to make him undertake his own responsibilities, to make him fulfill his obligations. But he was too different from her. His nature was purely sensuous, and she strove to make him moral, religious. She tried to force him to face things. He could not endure it. It drove him out of his mind. While the baby was still tiny, the father's temper had become so irritable that it was not to be trusted. The child had only to give a little trouble when the man began to bully. A little more, and the hard hands of the collier hit the baby. Then Mrs. Morell loathed her husband, loathed him for days, and he went out and drank, and she cared very little what he did. William, the eldest child, was only 3 years old, and his mother was proud of him, he was so pretty. She lay listening one Sunday morning to the chatter of the father and child downstairs. Then she dozed off. When she came downstairs, a great fire glowed in the grate, and seated in his armchair against the chimney-piece sat Morell, and standing between his legs, the child, cropped like a sheep, with such an odd, round poll. And on a newspaper spread out upon the hearthrug, a myriad of crescent-shaped curls, like the petals of a marigold, scattered in the firelight. Mrs. Morell stood still. She went very white, and was unable to speak.
"What dost think of him?"
Morell laughed uneasily. She gripped her two fists, lifted them, and came forward. Morell shrank back.
"I could kill you, I could," she said.
She choked with rage, her two fists uplifted.
"You don't want to make a wench on him,"
Morell said, in a frightened tone, bending his head to shield his eyes from hers. The mother looked down at the jagged, close-clipped head of her child.
"Oh, my boy,"
she faltered. Her lips trembled, her face broke, and snatching up the child, she buried her face in his shoulder and cried painfully. Morell sat with his elbows on his knees, his hands gripped together till the knuckles were white. Presently she came to an end, soothed the child, and cleared away the breakfast table. She left the newspaper, littered with curls, spread upon the hearthrug. At last her husband gathered it up and put it at the back of the fire. She went about her work with closed mouth and very quiet. Morell was subdued. She spoke to him civilly and never alluded to what he had done. But she knew, and Morell knew, that his act had caused something momentous to take place in her soul. She remembered the scene all her life as one in which she had suffered the most intensely. This act of masculine clumsiness was the spear through the side of her love for Morell. Before, while she had striven against him bitterly, she had fretted after him, as if he had gone astray from her. Now she ceased to fret for his love. He was an outsider to her.